Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 142, The Happiness Hypothesis, March 14th, 2008. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
When you are surrounded by facts and quotes and things like that, your eye can run over an idea, you can think about it consciously, but it won't really become wisdom until you have, I think, much more of an intuitive and emotional experience to it, until you see connections and feel its importance. And just as we get inflation when you pump too much money into the money supply, you get a kind of an inflation which leads to ultimately a cheapening of ideas when you pump too many ideas into every minute of your life. And we're just surrounded by good ideas now. I mean, think about ancient times when people had to trek up to a mountain to get wisdom from a guru. I mean, you know, all you have to do is look down at the bottom of your friend's emails these days. You'll find plenty of wisdom right there. But there's so much of it that we don't have emotional experiences to it.
That was the voice of my guest, Jonathan Haidt, Ph.D. Dr. Jonathan Haidt is a social and cultural psychologist. He received his Ph.D. from the University of Pennsylvania in 1992 and then did postdoctoral research at the University of Chicago and in Orissa, India. He has been on the faculty of the University of Virginia since 1995. His research focuses on morality, its emotional foundations, cultural variations, and developmental course. Dr. Haidt is the 2001 winner of the Templeton Prize in Positive Psychology and a 2004 winner of the Virginia Outstanding Faculty Award, conferred by Governor Mark Warner. He's the author of The Happiness Hypothesis, Finding Modern Truth in Ancient Wisdom. He was the Lawrence S. Rockefeller Distinguished Visiting Professor at Princeton University in 2006 to 2007. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Jonathan Haidt, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, Dave.
I'm really glad to have you here. Because of my long involvement with humanistic psychology, I've been very intrigued by developments in the positive psychology movement. I've been kind of a viewer from the sidelines, and I've interviewed several other people who are prominent in the movement. So how did you come to be involved with positive psychology?
I got involved at the very beginning just by a confluence of interests. My research has always been about morality. That's really what I do, and I look at the moral emotions. And I was studying especially the emotion of disgust. I'm kind of known as the big fish in the small stinking pond of disgust research.
Oh my goodness, you're the disgusting psychologist.
I am. That's right. I'm a student of Paul Rosin at the University of Pennsylvania. And my aspect of it, I was so interested in why disgust was used so much as a moral emotion, why the Bible and the Quran and most religions seem to moralize the body so much and care so much about menstruation and food and how you handle corpses and all those sorts of things. And it all pointed to disgust as a moral emotion. So that's what I did for a number of years. But then soon after I moved to the University of Virginia in 1995, I began thinking about the opposite of disgust. If disgust seemed to be functioning as a kind of a guardian of the boundary, the lower boundary between humans and animals, alerting us to the presence of the monstrous, is there a corresponding emotion at the upper end? Is there some emotion alerting us to the presence of divinity or angels or superhuman virtue? And just from reflecting on it, it seemed to me, well, yeah, there certainly is. You know, when I hear stories about moral beauty, I feel something. So I started studying it systematically and interviewing people and doing experiments. And this was about 1997, 98. And just then, Martin Seligman was putting out the call for young researchers who were interested in issues related to the positive side of human nature. And I answered the call and joined about 17 other young researchers at one of the first conferences in Acomal, Mexico, in I think 1998 or 99. And that was it. I've been involved since then.
So you had already received your PhD from the University of Pennsylvania at that point?
That's right. I got my PhD in 1992. Then I did a two-year postdoc with Richard Schwader at the University of Chicago, where I learned a lot more about cultural psychology, which has been just invaluable in understanding morality and emotion. And then I got my first faculty job at UVA in 1995.
Okay, and so that's interesting that the whole positive psychology thing kind of emerged with Dr. Seligman as the founder after you left Penn, which is where he is. And by the way, that's where I did my own undergraduate work. And I have to tell you that when I was at the University of Pennsylvania, it was all about rat psychology.
That's right. Things really changed in the late 60s or 70s, rather. When did you get your PhD? When did you graduate?
Well, it's quite a while back. It's 1962.
Oh, I see. So that was before Paul Rozin and most of the people I knew were there.
Yeah. So things have changed. I was really quite turned off to psychology by and large by my initial experiences there. It's only by a miracle that I found my way back into psychology. I also noticed in your acknowledgments, you mentioned John Barron, who I knew in graduate school at the University of Michigan. He was a friend of mine.
Oh, that's right. He went there. Yes, he was actually my advisor. I ended up doing more research with Paul Rozin and Alan Fiske, but technically, John Barron was my advisor.
Oh, my goodness.
Because he studies decision-making and had an interest in moral decision-making.
Oh, that's great. What a small world. I haven't had any contact with him in years and years. Well, the main title of your book is The Happiness Hypothesis, which suggests that there's some sort of underlying hypothesis or idea to be tested. So what's the hypothesis here in your wonderful book?
Well, first let me say that whatever a title suggests, the main thing it suggests is that a few people at the publisher talked together in the hallway and picked a title and forced it upon the author. In this case, I couldn't come up with a better one, but I'll tell you my original title was 12 Great Truths, Insights into Mind and Heart from Ancient Cultures and Modern Psychology. And then as I began to run out of time and writing the book, it became 10 Great Truths, Insights into Mind and Heart, etc. So the book isn't really about happiness primarily. It's really about the greatest ideas of all time, at least ideas about how the mind works. So I reviewed the ideas that I was beginning, that I was just finding all over the place about psychology from the ancients. And there's a chapter on each of the 10 main ideas, and each chapter reviews what we now know so we can say, is this idea true or not? And they're all true in some way, although some have some interesting exceptions. The publisher's basic book just decided to call it something with happiness. I resisted that, but I couldn't really come up with a better title. And by the time I really finished the book, I actually kind of accepted their title because it turns out there is sort of a happiness hypothesis here. The most obvious hypothesis is that people are happy when they get what they want, but that one we all know is wrong, and it's easy to demonstrate that empirically, that people are happy for hours maybe, but rarely for days from a success. The second hypothesis, which is much more sophisticated, much more widespread, is that happiness comes from within. Stop striving. You can never attain everything you want. Therefore, work on yourself. Only by working on yourself can you find happiness. This one you find certainly in the wisdom of the East. You find it in the Stoics. And there's a lot to be said for it. But what really excited me, and what I didn't know before I started writing the book, was that there's a further happiness hypothesis, one which I think is a little different and I think kind of exciting. It's one that people don't seem to have sort of guessed. It's not quite as obvious. It's that happiness comes not from within, but from between. That is, happiness comes from getting the right kind of engagement between yourself and others, yourself and your work, and yourself and something larger than yourself. We have to stop thinking about the world as being composed of these separate little atoms, and then each atom has to somehow work on itself, and rather see happiness or well-being or flourishing as something that emerges when a system is properly configured and all the parts are deeply engaged and enmeshed. That's the happiness hypothesis.
Okay, and the subtitle, if that's due to the publishers, well, that captures, I think, the core of what you were trying to get at in your original title, and the subtitle is Finding Modern Truth in Ancient Wisdom. And
that's right. And that's what the book is really about.
And I really love that aspect of it because it's really a tour de force in terms of integrating ancient wisdom traditions with some of the most recent findings in the whole world of psychology, and especially social psychology and positive psychology. And in fact, you set out on a reading expedition in the world's major traditions, which was, you know, quite astounding range you covered. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I was a philosophy major in college, and I was a philosophy major because I had a kind of an existential depression when I was in high school. Not a serious clinical depression, but just a sort of a depression at thinking through whether or not there was a God and deciding that pretty well seemed clear to me there wasn't, and then what are the implications of that? Is there any meaning in life? So I thought, well, I know, I'll major in philosophy and see if I can find the meaning of life. So I majored in philosophy, and I read philosophical works east and west, and didn't find much, especially in modern philosophy, but I liked Buddhism very much. And later on, many years later, then I sort of forgot about all of this stuff as I studied morality. But many years later, when I began teaching Psych 101 at UVA, I just found myself thinking of ways to illustrate psychological points. So here I was lecturing on, say, emotions and the importance of appraisals, or lecturing on the balance between various psychological systems and showing the importance of balance. And I found myself just wanting to use other quotations from literary sources, from ancient religious works, to illustrate these principles. So I just started doing that in my lectures. And then in the following years, I started numbering them and saying, well, these are major themes of the course. You know, major theme number one, the mind is divided into parts that sometimes conflict. And as I got up to about seven or eight of these, I started thinking, hey, I wonder how many of these there are. And I decided, well, maybe I could write a book on this. I could just, you know, do a little more systematic survey and write down every idea I found in all these ancient texts and then organize them, you know, into clusters and then write chapters. And that's how the book came about.
Well, I'm glad to understand something about the process, because I really found myself wondering, geez, how did he put this together? Because it is just chock so full of great stuff. And you draw upon Buddhism, as you mentioned, and you refer to a number of the most important Buddhist texts. You draw on Confucianism and Taoism, the ancient Greeks, the Romans, as well as a lot of classical philosophy. So my hat's off to you in that regard.
Well, thank you. It does represent just about every good idea I've ever had since I was in high school. At the end of the book, I felt like I can never write another one.
Yeah. Yeah. I got a chuckle in your introduction where you say we suffer from too much wisdom these days. You write, wisdom is now so cheap and abundant that it floods over us from calendar pages, tea bags, bottle caps, and mass email messages forwarded by well-meaning friends.
That's right. The I think a really important idea in the book is well, we'll probably get into this, the division between the rider and the elephant, the division between sort of conscious, explicit knowledge and more implicit, automatic, deeper, and more emotional knowledge. And when you are surrounded by facts and quotes and things like that, your eye can run over an idea, you can think about it consciously, but it won't really become wisdom until you have, I think, much more of an intuitive and emotional experience to it, until you see connections and feel its importance. And just as we get inflation when you pump too much money into the money supply, you get a kind of an inflation which leads to ultimately a cheapening of ideas, and you pump too many ideas into every minute of your life. And we're just surrounded by good ideas now. I mean, think about ancient times when people had to trek up to a mountain to get wisdom from a guru. I mean, you know, all you have to do is look down at the bottom of your friend's emails these days. You'll find plenty of wisdom right there. But there's so much of it that we don't have emotional experiences to it. So that was the idea, that I wasn't going to just try to make a long list. I was going to try to really draw readers through to seeing just how profound and important these ideas were. And it was a real switch for me to switch out of academic mode and to try to write to trigger more emotions, much more so than one does when submitting to the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, for example.
Yeah, that's the beauty of this book, is that it is really written, I think, for the layperson, although in no way offensive to, you know, to an academic. And it almost, you know, it's got this almost off-the-cuff feel, as if and I'm sure you do, you have all of this information at your command, and you're kind of telling us the story. So, and you use this metaphor very effectively throughout that you just alluded to of the rider, the small little rider on a great big elephant. In fact, if one looks closely at the cover, one realizes that there's actually a picture of that on the cover. I'd like to have you step us through the book, through those 10 great truths that you referred to earlier, and you devote a chapter to each one. You just gave us a little preview, I think, of that first one, the divided self. So, so what are you referring to there, the divided self?
So many, many experts, authorities, and reflective people have noticed that we often want to do something, but we don't do it. It's clearest in the case of addictions, but we see it throughout our lives when we resolve to do something, but we somehow, there's no external obstacle, yet we just don't do it.
Right. St. Paul, I think it is, who I seem to remember from my Sunday school, that which
exactly.
I do not, and that which I would not, I do, something along those lines.
Exactly. For what the flesh desires is opposed to the spirit, and what the spirit desires is opposed to the flesh. For these are opposed to each other to prevent you from doing what you want. So, yes, that's St. Paul. And Freud had a particular explanation of it. Plato had an explanation of it. Buddha has everyone has an explanation of it. And I think in many ways it's really a jumping off point for psychology. If this wasn't the case, psychology wouldn't be particularly interesting. It would be just sort of like taking apart a radio and figuring out how it works. But our lives are so puzzling to us because we get ourselves into such trouble, and we can see it so clearly in our friends much more easily than we can in ourselves. Basically, we're just not rational creatures. We don't behave as though we are making integrated use of all the information available to us. So I noticed this in my own life. When I was an assistant professor, I was dating, and I was living alone and running my own life on my own, and I just noticed there were certain mistakes I would make over and over again, some decisions I'd make knowing in part of my mind that it was the wrong decision, but that I was powerless to make another decision. and I wanted a metaphor to really capture this, and I could easily have used a horse and rider. It's what Plato uses and what many people have used. But I somehow, a horse is only maybe 5 or 6 times bigger than a person, and I wanted to convey the sense that really the unconscious mind, the automatic processes, are hundreds of times bigger. If you think about all the things our mind does in any moment, only one or two of them are conscious. The other dozens or hundreds are unconscious. So I just sort of amped it up to an elephant and a rider, and then lo and behold, Buddha had this great quote about how you have to tame your mind as a trainer tames an elephant. So I thought that just kind of worked for me and worked visually. And it seems to be an evocative image that it's the one thing that readers, when they write to me, when they meet me, they almost always bring up that metaphor. I think I was just very lucky in picking that metaphor for myself and having it also resonate well with readers.
And Freud also tried to make that same point, didn't he? Saying that maybe only about 5% of what we're aware of, is in our consciousness, and that the rest was unconscious.
Exactly. So modern psychology really gets its start. Certainly, it's not its start academically, but its start in the public eye with Freud. And I think it's quite relevant that we tend to take our metaphors from the technology of the day. So, in Freud's day, people rode horses. Everyone was very familiar with horses. Freud thought about horses. Where Freud went wrong, I believe, is in positing this vast, arcane, and bizarre architecture for the unconscious mind. Since the cognitive revolution, I think we have much better explanations for how the mind works. It does its stuff unconsciously, and it's not unconscious because we repressed it. It's unconscious because it has to be, because we're basically animals. We have these animal brains that do everything automatically and unconsciously. And then we also develop this little ability called language, so we can think consciously, but the mind didn't suddenly convert over to this whole new structure when we developed language in very recent evolutionary time. Rather, language has to be seen as a little additional ability that helps the animal mind do its job better. And so that's a more evolutionary explanation of the rider and elephant metaphor. The rider is very, very new evolutionarily. It's just not actually all that good, whereas the elephant is all these ancient systems that have been through thousands or millions of product cycles. Our sensory abilities, our motivational systems work extremely well. So that, I believe, is it gives you the same picture as Freud in terms of there being divisions, but it gives you a very different flavor in terms of what to think about the unconscious parts or the elephant.
Mm-hmm. And yet it does capture that part that the elephant is so much larger than the rider and therefore at times can be very difficult to control.
That's right. That's right. And I think actually another advantage of the metaphor is that elephants are really smart. You know, if you have a partnership between a horse and a rider, you can't quite say they're equals. But elephants are really smart animals. And the conclusion that I came to by the end of the book is that if you want to change yourself, you've got to beware of the trap of thinking that the rider can do it by himself. Effective change means training the elephant.
Well, that probably leads into the next chapter, which is called Changing Your Mind. Is that what you're discussing there? Is
Yes, that's right. Originally, I thought the book would be 10 chapters. I didn't know what the connections would be between them, but it ended up that there were some pretty natural transitions. And once you see the mind as being divided into an elephant and a rider, it is a pretty natural transition to the second truth. The second truth is probably the greatest truth of pop psychology. In fact, with this single sentence, you can explain probably 70% of the contents of the pop psychology bookshelf. Here it is in two forms. Here it is from Marcus Aurelius. The whole universe is change, and life itself is but what you deem it. Here it is from Buddha. What we are today comes from our thoughts of yesterday, and our present thoughts build our life of tomorrow. Our life is the creation of our mind. That is, we make our own reality.
And not just pop psychology, but isn't a lot of cognitive psychology, or at least cognitive therapy, is...
That's right. That was the essential connection. When we all know the line from Hamlet, I think is one of the best. There's nothing good or bad, but thinking makes it so. That's the line I would put up when I talked about cognitive psychology in my class. You know, you talk about Aaron Beck or any of the other cognitive therapists who point out that we don't react to the world as it is. We react to the world as we make it, and we tend to make it more scary and uncertain and negative than it is. So that was one of the original connections to the science that I saw in my class. And so in the chapter, I go through why it is, why it has to be this way, what are the, why it is that we are sort of set to be much more wary of threats, to see threats more so than opportunities, and why it is that people differ on this, why some people are prone to happiness and others are prone to fear and anxiety, and what are the means to change it. And so the three that I cover in the book, I think, are the three best established. That is cognitive therapy, meditation, and Prozac or other SSRIs. All three of those work because they change your automatic habitual patterns. The two methods that I would add, and readers have emailed me and suggested these things, and I think they're right. One is exercise. I didn't talk about that
because
it's psychologically interesting. But it certainly seems to be the case that if you simply get a good amount of exercise, it brightens your mood and it shifts you over more towards the approach side, and it just gives you more energy.
Mm-hmm. And what was the other one?
The other one is hypnosis, hypnotherapy. That also seems to have a pretty good track record. And boy, is it explicitly about talking to the elephant. I mean, that's really what a post-hypnotic suggestion is. You say, okay, rider, you just go to sleep. You just relax. Now, elephant, let me tell you a couple of things, and you remember them. So I think hypnosis is really quite, self-hypnosis appears to be quite effective. I'm doing some experiments with it right now in my Psych 101 class to see if I can use it to help students change themselves rapidly. Meditation is just wonderful. I mean, it has amazing effects and no bad side effects. The problem is, if you assign 100 people to do it, as I have in my class, if you assign 100 people to do it, the great majority are going to be, they're going to be done with it within 2 or 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. It's just very hard.
Yes.
Whereas cognitive therapy and Prozac are just much easier to do. So I think you end up having a higher success rate with them. I mean, I highly recommend meditation. It's just that most people are going to end up, unless they have a great teacher and a lot of discipline, they're going to end up dropping it.
I think you're the only person I've ever heard recommend meditation and Prozac in the same breath.
Hey, there are a lot of roads to the same end, many ways to skin a cat.
And that's one of the things I really love about this book and about your approach. Well, let's move along. In the next chapter, you talk about reciprocity, which in a way seems like an unusual word to use for what you're talking about.
Well, I think it's the correct word if you think evolutionarily and functionally, as I often do. I find it's a very useful unifying framework. And actually, I'll defend my use of it because it's the word that Confucius used when, here's the opening quote, Zigong, one of his disciples, asked, is there any single word that could guide one's entire life? The master, Confucius, said, should it not be reciprocity? What you do not wish for yourself, do not do unto others. I'm a social psychologist, and I like to think about what are the most important principles in any field. And I think if I had to nominate one for social behavior, it would be reciprocity, much more so than self-esteem or a lot of other things that get bandied about.
So that's basically the statement of the golden rule, right? Just a slightly different way of stating it.
Exactly. That's why the golden rule is golden. That's why you find it in every culture. It's not because these cultures got together. It's not because God gave it to them. It's because we all evolved to become cooperative creatures because we mastered the art of reciprocity. And that is the secret to why we cover the earth.
Okay. Now, was there more that you wanted to say about that before moving on?
Sure. I could just say this is a short. It's a fairly short chapter because the idea is so straightforward and so well understood. But the fun thing in the chapter was I read this really great book by Robert Cialdini, one of the leading social psychologists.
Yes.
He has a book called Influence.
Yes.
It's a great book. A lot of people read it in social psych classes. And he goes through some really wonderful techniques for using reciprocity to your advantage. We live in a world full of marketers who fully understand reciprocity. They give you free samples, and it turns out that you're more likely to buy with a free sample. The waitress puts a mint on your check, and she's giving you a little gift. You're going to give her more money.
Mm-hmm.
There's just so many little things where people use reciprocity to try to trick you into doing things. And so in the chapter, I cover some of Cialdini's advice for how to use reciprocity, how to fight fire with fire, and how to use reciprocity to make your relationships go better and to avoid being manipulated. So I think it ends up being a pretty useful chapter.
Yes. Now, the next chapter is called The Faults of Others. And isn't it their fault?
Well, we are all imperfect. But I think that the greatest imperfection is in the software of our moral psychology. This is the first chapter that I really got to get into the things that I most care about morality. And this writing this chapter really affected me, and it actually is leading on to what's going to be my next book, which is going to be basically on self-righteousness. So here, everybody knows the quote from Jesus in the Gospels, why do you see the speck in your neighbor's eye, but do not notice the log in your own? You a hypocrite. First take the log out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to take the speck out of your neighbor's eye.
Yes.
Buddha says the same thing. It's easy to see the faults of others, but difficult to see one's own faults.
Mm-hmm.
One shows the faults of others like chaff winnowed in the wind, but one conceals one's own faults as a cunning gambler conceals his dice. So we evolved to play social games. We have a lot of software up in our heads to manipulate our reputations. Our success doesn't depend so much on outrunning lions and tigers and bears. It depends primarily on getting others to cooperate with us and trust us and work with us. So we are masters of that. But we also take shortcuts, and then we deny that we took shortcuts. We are extremely good at telling stories about ourselves to others, and these stories are so loosely connected to our actual behavior that we are all hypocrites. We can see this in others. It's very easy to see in others, but it's very hard to see in ourselves. This is one of the areas that all the ancients seem to have gotten. When you look around the world, the wisdom traditions, they all have this one. And I think it's one of the most important truths. It's the most important truth in moral psychology. It's one that I'm very excited about. And ultimately, it's one that's very freeing. Once you realize that you're a hypocrite, what I find happens is that I am so much better at apologizing now. When I get in a fight with my wife or with anyone else, rather than doing all the usual moral psychology stuff, which is you set out to look for ever more evidence to back you up. That's what we do automatically. And I find myself doing that and say, wait a sec. All right, let me just look at the other person's point of view. In what way might that person be right about something? And you can always find a way that the other person is right about something. They may not be right overall, but they're always right about something, and you're always wrong about something. And once you see that, what happens is you get out of your state of high moral dudgeon, you get out of your state of self-righteousness, and you're freed up to make an apology. Maybe just a limited apology, but you're freed up to say, hey, you know what, honey? I understand why you got mad at me for this. You thought X, and I can understand that if you thought X, it totally makes sense that you got so mad at me. And once you do that, by the very power of reciprocity, covered in Chapter 3, the other person is likely to say, oh, well, thanks. You know, but I understand why you said Y or whatever. So I think this is ultimately the key to liberation, the key to liberation from our state of constant righteousness and anger.
And I suppose that you're able to draw support for this from psychology and not just from Buddha and Buddha and Jesus.
Oh, yes. There's wonderful work on biases by Emily Pronin at Princeton, Lee Ross at Stanford. There's just wonderful experimental work on just how biased we are. How, you know, for example, if you ask people, how good are you at driving? Or how big is your vocabulary? Or how honest are you? People always expect that they rate themselves as being in the 80th or 90th percentile. And it's no matter what you do, it turns out if you say, look, this is what everybody says. Now, are you really, you know, in the 90th percentile of leadership? No matter what you do, you can't debias people. Nobody's yet found a way to really debias people. We really cling to these.
That is so fascinating.
That's the nature of the creature. That's who we are. We are we're designed for self-presentation and showing off. Now, of course, there are obviously big cultural variations here. And in Japan, they actually have almost a sort of a cultural mechanism of self-denigration. So these things do tend. I don't know what the research is on Japan. They do show up in Europe, slightly less than the U.S., but they do show up in Europe. So I can't quite say that all of this is. Well, no, of course I can say it's universal. Buddha said it about India, and you certainly find philosophers in China as well. So I do think it's a universal aspect of human psychology.
Your next chapter is called The Pursuit of Happiness. What are you getting at there?
So there's an enormous amount of research on happiness. This is really the first time the book turns to the subject of happiness. and here, this chapter, I began just by reviewing all of the enormous amount of work pouring in positive psychology, it's a great story. I mean, the work is really coming together. Not my work; I don't do research on this, but I just was simply standing on the shoulders of giants here, like Ed Diener. Let's see. Here's a quote from Epictetus. So this is that second happiness hypothesis I mentioned, the one that happiness comes from within. So Epictetus says, "Do not seek to have events happen as you want them to, but instead want them to happen as they do happen, mm-hmm. and your life will go well."
Mm-hmm.
The basic idea here is that there's a very weak connection between what happens to us in the world and how happy we are. Very, very weak. Events have very little impact on our happiness. Rather, our happiness level seems to be mostly set by our genes. Some people are born to be optimistic, some born to be pessimistic. And we get little flashes of pleasure when we make progress towards goals. But the point of these is to drive us on to do things that are good for us. It's not to make us lastingly happy. If our ancestors were lastingly happy, they wouldn't have striven very hard, and they wouldn't have gone on to become our ancestors. In the sense, we were not destined as a species to ever find contentment. We were destined to strive. So I cover some of the psychology behind that striving, why we adapt so quickly to successes and failures, why there are differences between people, why some environmental factors make a difference in our happiness. They're primarily things that connect us to others socially. So relationships, being married, being religious, these things do matter quite a bit for our happiness. Not because they satisfy our material needs, but because they connect us to others socially. This is the huge benefit of religion and marriage. So this is where I began to develop the idea that happiness comes from between. I didn't realize that until after I'd finished this chapter, and then that conclusion, that third happiness hypothesis, became the concluding chapter of the book. But that's what this fifth chapter on the pursuit of happiness is all about.
Yes, and so it seems like you end up taking issue a little bit with Buddhism and the quote that you just read from Epictetus.
Yes.
Where they seem to urge acceptance of what is.
That's right.
But
this is the one area where I have taken some flack from readers. A number of readers have criticized me here. Because the conclusion that I come to, when I started the book, I thought that Buddha was the best psychologist who ever lived. And I've always been very drawn to Buddhism.
Me too.
And yeah, as you know, as a lot of people in psychology are, and as a lot of Jews are, so for some reason, Judaism seems to not satisfy a certain aspect that Buddhism does. I don't know why that is, but At any rate, so I think Buddha is, of course, extraordinarily wise about the ways of the mind and how to tame it and improve it. But the general view you get from reading Buddhist texts, and it's even clear in the ancient texts, is that it's really, really important to calm the passions and to separate yourself from the ups and downs of life. That, I think, is absolutely at the core, at the heart of Buddhism. And many of us in the West read this and we think, oh, very wise, very wise. You know, we Westerners, we're too passionate. We get angry about things. We get too happy about things. Then we're disappointed. Better to calm the passions. Well, the view that I came to after really thinking about Buddhism in the context of more recent research on flow and meaning and happiness is that there are many routes to a rich and fulfilled life. And I think the Western idea of passionate engagement actually has a lot to recommend it, in particular when you're young. I don't think that a life of detachment, a life where you try to avoid the ups and downs, as Buddhism and Hinduism urge you, is necessarily a good life for a young person. That might be a good state to come to when you're much more advanced in years. But I think we need to love and be burned. We need to strive and fail, and we need to hurt. And as a result of those, we grow from all those things. So I do end up questioning the Buddhist wisdom that happiness comes from within, and it comes largely from separating your mental state from the ups and downs, the inevitable ups and downs of life. I think actually the roller coaster ends up being pretty good for us as long as you can temper it, and that's where I think it's important to keep Buddhist insights in part of your mind at all times. Some readers have said I've misunderstood Buddhism, and certainly what I'm saying is not true of modern Buddhism, which is very, very Americanized and sort of nice. If you read the ancient texts, they're pretty cold. You know, they really say, you know, don't love your wife. You know, a man who loves a woman is, shackled like a beast to a chain or something like that.
Oh, my goodness.
The ancient texts have a very, very different feel from say, you know, Thich Nhat Hanh or the Dalai Lama.
Exactly. I was thinking of Thich Nhat Hanh as when you use the term passionate engagement. Mm-hmm. So you're right. There is a somewhat more modern spin.
That's right. Yeah, and that makes a lot of sense. I mean, I think Buddhism modernized is, you know, would then be right, because as I said, the ancient texts I think are really not quite right, especially not for living in a Western way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, in another chapter, you talk about the uses of adversity, and I know we all have this teabag wisdom that has come to us that what doesn't break you only makes you stronger.
That's right. And anybody who knows anything about post-traumatic stress disorder would say no. Sometimes what doesn't kill you just leaves you damaged for life.
Mm.
It can, you know, it damages your amygdala and changes your amygdala and your hippocampus, and you will forever be jumpier, more irritable, more depressed. That's what happened to an awful lot of people who were traumatized in war or by rape or by other atrocities. So how do we separate this? How do we know when adversity makes us stronger, and how do we know when it's going to damage us? And this is one I knew very little about clinical psychology before I wrote the book, but there's some wonderful work going on in clinical psychology, especially around an area called post-traumatic growth, which I thought was just fascinating. Mm. There is a lot of research on how people who, say, survive cancer end up being much stronger. I guess, you know, a couple of basic principles here. One is that, the rich get richer and the happy get happier. People who are born optimistic are much more likely to grow from adversity than people who are born pessimistic. That's the first thing. Second thing is that there are certain kinds of traumas and adversities that connect us more closely to others. So suffering from cancer is a great one. Boy, do people rally around. I mean, there's been a lot of cancer in my family, and I've seen it among some friends. People really rally around. So, you know, cancer is general. I mean, you lose some relationships, I hear, but cancer, generally speaking, if you survive it, it's a very good candidate for making you stronger. Whereas getting raped or something like that is a terrible candidate. It doesn't tend to strengthen relationships. It involves elements of shame and damages your ability to trust. So I don't think we can say that what doesn't kill you makes you stronger as a blanket statement. I think we do need some really important qualifications on what kinds of adversity and what kinds of people.
Okay. Yeah, I'm going to want to follow up on that post-traumatic growth idea. I'm going to look in your references and find somebody to interview, because that's kind of a new concept that I haven't explored.
Oh, good. Yeah, there's an edited volume on it. I can't remember the authors offhand, but you'll see in the references the edited volume. And I love reading those papers.
Yeah, that's great. And then you've got one of your closing chapters is on the felicity of virtue.
Yes. Here we have the idea, you know, it's another platitude, like what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, is virtue is its own reward. And it would be lovely to believe that. It would be lovely to believe that if people just do good, they will end up better off. And there are surely times when that's true, but there are many times when it's not. Giving your money away sometimes will just make you poorer, not richer. So I just set out to look at what is known about when doing good ends up being good for you. And what I found is that the key here is our notions of virtue and morality, which have so narrowed in modern times. For the ancients, virtues were excellences of living. They were social excellences, social skills that made you more appealing as a member of society. And if you think about it that way, then living in a way that makes you more appealing, living in a way that is responsible and frugal and industrious and all the sorts of virtues that Ben Franklin talked about, yeah, if you've got those, you're going to be just a better person and you'll be more successful in life because you'll have the basic skills of living with yourself and others. What's happened is that since the 19th century, and especially in the 20th, our notion of morality has narrowed to the point where we think morality is helping others and not hurting them. And so much of moral psychology is on altruism. It's on, you know, giving money or help to individuals. And so we've so narrowed our concept of virtue or morality that now to say giving help or money to others will be good for you, well, that's a very different statement from the one that Franklin was making when he wrote about this. Sometimes it's true and sometimes it's not. So I reviewed the literature on when charity and altruism and social volunteer work helps people, and it turns out there's not really any evidence that it does so for kids, for teenagers, but there's a lot that it does so for the elderly. And as with everything else, it comes back to relationships. Kids are so immersed in relationships, if you make them do a bunch of volunteer work, they don't need any more relationships. The elderly are losing their relationships. They are at great risk from isolation. And when they do volunteer work, they meet people, they do it with other people. So volunteer work seems to be very, very good for the elderly. And the story gets complicated in a number of ways, but as with everything, the main place to look is relationships.
Okay. Well, it's interesting to hear about these complications because the impression that I've gotten from positive psychology so far has been kind of validating notions about generosity, forgiveness, altruism, and so on.
Mm-hmm. Right. Those are the findings that are the most newsworthy and they're the ones that we're hungriest for.
Yes.
And they're generally true. I'm not disagreeing with them. I'm just saying that the platitudes that we would like to believe are usually only partially true, mm-hmm. and they're often exceptions.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. And then you say divinity with or without God.
Mm-hmm.
What are you getting at there?
One of the largest categories or the fastest growing categories of American religion is spiritual but not religious. Most people don't describe themselves as non-spiritual. My view as a person raised Jewish but who became an atheist very early on is that it's very, very unlikely that there's an actual God. I mean, who knows? Nobody can be certain, but it seems to me unlikely that the similarities in religions and religious experiences and the differences are due to the fact that there's a God up there who, you know, made it all true. On the other hand, the similarities of religious experience, in particular, feelings of awe and transformation and spiritual transformation, which I studied, as I was studying these positive moral emotions I spoke about before, I got particularly interested in feelings of awe and self-transcendence. These are so similar around the world, and there's so many ways to get them, from drugs, from spinning around, and the whirling dervishes, people use spinning, bowing in prayer.
Yes.
Psychedelic drugs, there's so many ways to get this state. So I take the experiences of self-transcendence to be just simply a part of our nature. We have these feelings. We have these feelings of approaching God, of being higher versus lower, of being nobler or more base. And these are, after feelings of love, these are some of the most cherished and subtle and important feelings we have. So this chapter explores this aspect of human experience, one which scientists and philosophers are often somewhat blind to in their desire to just sort of state things clearly and to derive them logically. this is where a lot of my research had been when I was studying these feelings of moral elevation, which means to be lifted up. And the conclusion that that I come to here is that religious people and religious texts really are advising us on an aspect of humanity that we in the sciences are kind of tin-eared to. We just do a bad job with.
Mm-hmm.
And I end up, as a result of doing this research over many years and then writing this chapter, I end up becoming much, much more tolerant of and interested in religions and religious traditions. I don't think I'll ever be a believer, but a really important point that I think people need to keep in mind with regard to these wars over religion nowadays is that religion isn't really about belief. You know, Richard Dawkins and Dan Dennett and the people who write these atheism books, they take it as though religion means believing in Jesus Christ and that he created the world 6,000, or whatever, that God created the world 6,000 years ago. And, you know, those beliefs exist, but religion is really about practices that bind people together into cooperative communities. God is really just a maypole that allows us to circle around, and in the circling, we join together. That's what religion really is. So writing this book has really changed me and made me. I now write and sometimes appear on the side of people who are arguing in defense of religion. I mean, it certainly has aided and abetted many atrocities. But I think we have to at least understand this aspect of human nature, that we have these feelings. These feelings sometimes do drive us on to do higher, nobler, better things. And the evidence for the social benefits of religion, I think, is pretty compelling.
Okay. Well, at the end of your book, you stress the need for balance, and perhaps we should close off our interview with any advice that you might have for listeners on just how they would find that balance.
Okay, let's see. I guess I should have some very succinct way to say this. I think it's just to recognize that we are really parts of larger wholes. We evolved to be deeply enmeshed in families and groups. And when we set off to live on our own, we actually don't do so well. We tend to be self-righteous. We tend to look only for evidence that supports us. We're very good at seeing part of the picture, the part that we want to see, and then supporting that with every bit of evidence we can find. I think mental health and a flourishing life come from living in a different way. And you can't just be the rider and say, okay, I'm going to find balance. You have to change your life so that it ends up coming to you. Part of that, I think, would be simply exposing yourself to people, especially people, not just books, but people on the other side. So if you're an atheist, get to know some religious people. Go to some churches. People are extremely nice in church. I do an assignment in my moral psychology class where everyone has to do moral field work. They have to actually go out and meet people and talk to them, people who they strongly disagree with. And they almost always come back saying, wow, they were really nice. I mean, I still don't agree with them, but, you know, now at least I can understand why they think what they think. So, once again, the theme of the book is it all comes back to relationships. If you can at least cultivate relationships with people who are different from you, especially on matters of religion and politics, I think you can at least come to respect people who are different from you. And that is very freeing. That has been so liberating for me. I'm still a political liberal, but I find so many conservative ideas really interesting. It's really helping my research because I have this vast field, this vast area of ideas that I can explore in. And most of my colleagues in psychology and social psychology, you know, we're all liberal. Everybody's liberal. But for them, there's kind of a fence there that says, do not enter because these are ugly ideas or these are not liberal ideas. So I think that we can escape from a lot of traps. We can improve our lives. We can free ourselves from a lot of moralism if we seek out people and ideas who are different from where we are now.
Well, you're a fascinating guy, and I've enjoyed this interview and really enjoyed your book, and highly recommend it to all my listeners. So, Dr. Jonathan Haidt, thanks so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, Dr. Dave, it's been my pleasure. I really enjoyed talking with you.
I hope you found this conversation with Dr. Jonathan Haidt as fascinating as I did. As you could tell from the interview, I'm quite impressed by his book, The Happiness Hypothesis, And I recommend it without reservation. It's extremely readable and engaging. Let me give you a bit of the flavor of it by reading from a passage toward the end of the book. What can you do to have a good, happy, fulfilling, and meaningful life? What is the answer to the question of purpose within life? I believe the answer can be found only by understanding the kind of creature that we are, divided in the many ways we are divided. We are shaped by individual selection to be the selfish creatures who struggle for resources, pleasure, and prestige, and we were shaped by group selection to be the creatures who long to lose ourselves in something larger. We are social creatures who need love and attachments, and we are industrious creatures with needs for effectance, able to enter a state of vital engagement with our work. We are the rider and we are the elephant, and our mental health depends on the two working together, each drawing on the other's strengths. I don't believe there's an inspiring answer to the question, what is the purpose of life? Yet by drawing on ancient wisdom and modern science, we can find compelling answers to the question of purpose within life. The final version of the happiness hypothesis is that happiness comes from between. Happiness is not something you find, acquire, or achieve directly. You have to get the conditions right and then wait. Some of those conditions are within you, such as coherence among the parts and levels of your personality. Other conditions require relationships to things beyond you, just as plants need sun, water, and good soil to thrive. People need love, work, and a connection to something larger. It is worth striving to get the right relationships between yourself and others, between yourself and your work, and between yourself and something larger than yourself. If you get these relationships right, a sense of purpose and meaning will emerge. So says Dr. Hite, and I heartily agree. If you're interested to learn more, you might visit www.happinesshypothesis.com, where you will find happiness exercises, resource links, as well as a guide for teachers/professors who wish to use the book in a psychology class. I'll have to check that last one out myself.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.
I want to remind you that my good friend Jerry Trumbull and I are planning to do another Shrink Wrap Radio Live this Sunday, March 16th at 9 a.m. Pacific Time. You can listen in live, post comments in the chat area, or call in on the phone line. Just go to www.blogtalkradio.com/shrinkwrapradio. Now, the focus of our discussion will be communication, and we'll be referring to a wonderful article in the March National Geographic titled Inside Animal Minds. You can find the full text of this article on the National Geographic website with a little hunting. We'll also discuss communication in autism, drawing upon an article in the March issue of Wired magazine. Now, I'm not sure if that article is online, but for your homework, go to YouTube and do a search on Amanda Bags, that's spelled B-A-G-G-S. You will be amazed. And if there's time, we'll talk a bit about the HBO series on psychotherapy called In Treatment. We haven't had an addition to our Frapper map in ages, so please add yourself if you aren't there already. You'll find a link to it on our site. I know we have many new listeners. I need to let you know that although this is show number 142, Our feed and iTunes currently only displays from number 68 on, but you'll find the first 67 shows archived on our website, and they're still as timely as ever. And you should know that I have another podcast series in which I interview therapists and academics at www.wisecounselpodcast.com. And there's a new interview up there now. It's with Richard Schulman, PhD, and it's about his program in Hartford, Connecticut called Volunteers in Psychotherapy, in which therapy clients get free psychotherapy in exchange for donating their time to various charitable organizations. It's a wonderful model, and you should definitely check that out. As usual, the sponsors for this show are Podshow and GoDaddy. Thanks to all of you who have bought domain names and such at GoDaddy and used the discount codes on our Shrink Wrap Radio website. Those discounted purchases help to support this show.
Yeah, man, it's Shrink Wrap Radio, straight out of San Francisco, California. Hey, so you're the thing, the pod guy, I say, all right? Okay. Bring up the doctor, dude. Shrink Wrap Radio. Oh, it'll be a smart. You have to go. Oh, Shrink Wrap Radio. The doctor and the Ali Ray. Shrink it up. Shrink Wrap Radio. Take them away, Dr. Dave!
Thanks to Paul for that reggae transition. Paul teaches philosophy at a community college in Quebec. And now let's go to some recent listener emails. In fact, Reggae Paul sent an email recently in which he says, "Very interesting show on death recently. Reminded me a lot of what Heidegger has to say on the way that death strips away what is least important." Warmest, Paul. So thanks, Paul, for your email and for that transition. I hope others will send transitions as well. Next, we hear from Joan in Australia, who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I wanted to thank you and Dr. John Beebe so very much for the recent podcast, Adventures in Jungian Typology. I must admit, when I first started to listen to this session, I could not sit still and concentrate on it. I was trying to listen amongst all the distractions of my home environment, which did not do justice to the pace and richness of the podcast. Luckily, I continued to listen while driving, and I soon became engrossed in the marvelous conversation. Apparently, the trucks and traffic lights are a fine accompaniment to this topic. Several years ago, when I participated in a Myers-Briggs training session, I found a real personal benefit and great insight into the tricky business of dealing with many different types of people. While it may not be a perfect theory, and it is often clumsily misused, I still find it valuable to stay alert for the variations in type that people display, and to have some tools to deal with the fireworks when the occasional clashes occur. I was thrilled to hear Dr. Beebe explain the Jungian typology so clearly. Also, for the first time, I have some grasp of the way Freud's work and Jung's relate to each other. Although I have read and listened to various explanations before, I must say nothing else really clicked for me on these topics. I look forward to listening carefully to this podcast again. It's a real treasure trove. If you and Dr. Beebe have the opportunity to continue this type of discussion in a future podcast, I think it would be really worthwhile. Kind regards from Australia, Joe." Joe, thanks a lot for that comment. It was very welcome because that conversation, I thought, got off to kind of a slow start anyway, and I was a little concerned about it. And I had edited it out a bunch of the ahs and ums, which slowed it down. And then somehow that file became corrupted, and so I had to put it up without all that editing work, because I had put 2 or 3 hours into it. So I'm glad that it came across well. And I am planning to do a subsequent podcast interview sometime down the road with Dr. Beebe, when his book on the feminine in film comes out. So we can look forward to that. Next, Alicia writes from Japan. Hello again, Dr. Dave. I've been meaning to write you for some time and ask if you could expound on a comment you made some time back on one of your Shrink Wrap Radio podcasts. I can't remember the exact quote, but I believe you said something to the effect that, looking back over your career as a therapist, there is nothing you've done that you couldn't have done with a master's in marriage and family therapy as opposed to your PhD. Did you mean to say that if you were an undergraduate student contemplating your graduate studies and career path today, you might choose to pursue a MFT degree rather than a clinical psych PhD? Over the next few weeks, I'm facing the difficult decision of choosing between beginning a MSW program or a MFT master's program this coming year, or reapplying for admission to a counseling psych PhD program next year. This year, there were 180 applicants for 8 openings, and I wasn't one of the lucky 8, unfortunately. As I've mentioned in previous posts, I'm applying from Japan, so I feel a bit removed from the academic world right now, just hoping I might glean a little wisdom from someone who has walked this path before me. Many thanks for your continuous contributions to my education. Respectfully, Alicia. Alicia, that's not exactly what I said. I would still get a PhD looking back at the fact that I've had an academic career. Now, I didn't initially plan on having an academic career or know that I was going to have one. If you're going to do university or college teaching, you really probably do need to have that PhD. Unless you get an MSW, it is possible for an MSW sometimes to teach at the university level, since the master's in social work is considered a terminal degree. But even there, I think for university teaching, they would prefer a PhD. If you're planning strictly to do private practice psychotherapy, then yes, it's true, the MFT is perfectly fine, as is the MSW. I believe the MSW to be a somewhat more powerful degree. So if you can find one that's oriented towards psychotherapy, and many of them are not, then I think that would be a good way to go. We'll wrap it up for today with one more short one from Axel in Germany. And I have to say, I'm really loving the international reach of this podcast and hearing from people who are abroad. Axel writes, "Hello, David. My warmest congratulations to you and your family for your new member of the family. I happened to mention on a recent podcast that I've just been made a grandfather for a second time." He says, "Isn't a child always a new wonder? Well, I have a child myself, 2 years old, and my wife's got 2 from her first marriage, so I know what I'm talking about. I wish you all the best and keep up your great shows. I'm still listening. Axel from Germany. P.S. I listened to the interview with Annie Fox on Wise Counsel together with my students at school, and it was very interesting and helpful to compare the differences and similarities between American and German teens in class. We already wrote an email to Annie, which she answered. Thanks for the shows." How neat. I'm so glad to hear it when this material that I generate here gets used in classroom settings. So that better wrap it up for today. Remember, you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave voicemails on the site. You can leave using MyChingo. You can leave voicemails using Skype by leaving it for ShrinkPod. Our phone is 206-337-0622. Thanks again to my guest, Dr. Jonathan Haidt, for his insights on the psychology of happiness. And my next guest will be New York psychoanalyst, Dr. Fern W. Cohen, talking about her experiences on both sides of the couch. I hope you'll join us for that show. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.